We are gathered here this evening to hear a guest speaker from Canada, from the New World. He was one time Christian church worker. He spent a lot of his time and energies in studying various philosophies and religions. He had studied the Quran, the passage whereof you just heard recited by that 13-year-old boy. He has been to several countries on lecture tours of this nature. This is not, I must emphasize, a propaganda meeting. It is not a meeting to spread any particular faith. In Islam, it is a cardinal principle which most people do not appreciate, that your faith, the faith of another is his, and the faith of a Muslim is his. The Quran specifically states, لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ وَلِيَدِينَ, which means, your faith is yours, mine is mine. There is no question of attempting to convert anybody. Today, Mr. Gary Miller, now Abdul Ahmad Omar, will speak to you on some aspects of this matter. Abdul Ahmad Omar.
If you are at all confused, maybe you saw a picture that was taken of me about a year ago, or a videotape or something. It's the same man. He used to have a beard, and he used to weigh about 40 pounds more, but all of those changes are for certain reasons and doesn't really matter. In any case, there are a lot of misunderstandings, maybe about who I am and what I do. It results in some funny situations sometimes. Very often, in many countries, in particular in the U.S. and Canada, on the university campuses, there are church groups who from time to time decide it would be a good idea to have a debate with the Muslims. So they approach the Muslim students, who are generally foreign students. They come from all over the world. And they tell them, we'd like to have a debate, so why don't you bring a Muslim speaker, and we'll bring a Christian speaker, and we'll have a debate. And the brothers always think that'd be a good idea, and they get in touch with me. And a few days before the debate, it happens again and again. A few days before the debate, the Christian group will say, so who is the Muslim speaker that's coming? And they tell them, well, his name is Miller. And they always say the same thing. They say, that's not fair. We want a Muslim speaker. It makes them very nervous to find out that there are Muslims who have names like Miller and Smith and Jones. They want somebody who might stumble through the English language or be unaware of certain basic things, and they can make a fool of it. That's really all they had in mind. When they find out that, after all, the speaker comes from the same piece of territory that you do, it makes them a little worried. Recently, in fact, We had a session where there were two Muslims speaking and two ministers speaking. Well, one of the Muslims was myself, and the other one was named Steve Johnson. Used to be a Jesuit priest. That's the way the face of Islam is changing in many parts of the world. Some of the best Muslims I've met are not what people usually think of as coming from Muslim territory. They are American or German or Danish or Korean or Chinese. People don't usually think of that as being the Muslim world. There's another thing I don't do, though. I don't go around giving testimonials, telling you, you know, I used to be such a terrible person and then I became a Muslim, or I used to do this, but now I do this, and so on. I'm not really interested in doing that kind of thing. To some people, that's all they want to do. That's part of some religions. You get a blessing every time you tell somebody how bad you used to be and how good you are now. Even if they've heard it before, tell them again. Testimonials. I don't do that kind of thing. I don't think I was that bad before, to start with. I'm also not a professional missionary. Nobody pays me to go from place to place and give speeches. I have a job, or I used to, which I quit a couple of years ago, and before too long, the money's going to run out and I have to go back to work. But I took some time off to take the invitations that people give. I don't arrive uninvited. Somebody makes the arrangements for me. And it has grown into a productive kind of a thing. I could probably tell you nice stories for several hours about experiences, but that's not the point of this exercise. The talk is advertised as Muslims, misguided or misunderstood. And I suppose you might think, well, if a Muslim is speaking, he's going to explain that Muslims are not misguided, they're misunderstood. And basically, that's what I have in mind. But I would like to show why they might be misunderstood. Whose fault is it? And is it a fair accusation to say that they are misguided, as some people say? Probably every one of you could tell us some funny story about how Muslims are misunderstood. Maybe I've got more stories than you just by being in more cities, but there's always somebody who has a very deep misunderstanding of Islam. I remember a few years ago working alongside a man. We used to talk a little bit now and then about religion. But one day he told me he didn't want to talk about it anymore. He said, look, you have your religion and I have mine. He said, Jesus died for my sins, Muhammad died for your sins, doesn't matter. Well, you see the beginning of the kind of misunderstandings that go on, the point I'm trying to make. He imagines that all religions work the same. And because in his religion, there's someone, they say, he died for my sins, well, then it must be in my religion, you've got someone who died for your sins. It just shows the depth of ignorance. I don't say that to be unkind, but it just shows how deeply misunderstood Islam is. And every time you think you've met somebody who is the most ignorant person you've ever met, I promise you, you will meet another man more ignorant before too long. You cannot overestimate people's ignorance. There are misunderstandings that you can't imagine. A woman said to me, and this is a university student in Florida, you'd think she's well educated and so on. And before we started a talk, she came up to me and she's kind of angry. And she said, she wanted to know, what are you going to say for the next hour? She said, how are you going to convince me that Jesus isn't the Son of God, but Muhammad is? Well, I'll try to explain to her. I'm not even going to try. But she imagined that's what I'm going to do. What those two little stories illustrate is that there are things that all of us should remember to watch out for. It's how we often misunderstand things. We tend to forget that our impression of something or our interpretation of what we see might not be the real thing. We might be getting an impression, but it's not the way things really are. And if we always think that, well, what seems to be the case is the case, we might be wrong. To give you an example, In North America, you have a lot of mosques being built these days, and a lot of people find that very interesting. So high school students and different clubs and so on, they come for a tour of the mosque. They'll make an arrangement, somebody meets them at the mosque, and they show them around. And there's a frequent comment that people make. They say, "We noticed when we were watching the Muslims praying, the women pray behind the men. That's because in Islam, women are less than men, isn't it?" That's what they think is the reason for what they see. Women stand behind men. That doesn't have anything to do with why the women stand behind the men. It isn't true in the first place that somehow women are less than men. But that's the impression they have. That's the meaning they think that this has for what they see. And they go away thinking that's the real thing. Unless they have spoken up and somebody's had the good sense to explain to them, no, no, no. That's not why women stand behind men. You could look at it in many different ways. The women standing behind the men solves a problem, for one thing. The women could stand in front of the men, but I don't think women would like to do that. I don't think they'd like to perform salat, to make sujood, and there's men standing behind them. That might make them nervous. Or the women could stand beside the men. But I don't think I'd be comfortable trying to pray, and someone's wife is sitting here, somebody else's wife is over here, and my wife is sitting next to somebody over there. Or the women can stand behind the men. Well, that doesn't cause any problems. But that's one way of looking at that. It solves a problem, but it doesn't have anything to do with somehow male is better than female. But that's the meaning people give it. That's what they think Islam teaches. So what I'd like to do is mention this and some other things to try to clarify things, to make clear the things that people often misunderstand. Let me give an example now and go into some details of one of the ways that people fool themselves. Yeah, just keep it down a little bit and start to squeal at me all the time. We can... No, down, not up. Down, thank you. We fool ourselves if we think in this way. If we have something that we believe in, and then we tend to think, well, what is the opposite of what I believe? Well, the opposite of what I believe must be what everybody else believes, because they don't believe what I believe. That's a way of fooling yourself. That's something like the way the man thinks who thinks, well, now, I believe Jesus died for my sins, so that man must believe Muhammad died for his sins. See, he's tried to find what's the opposite of what I believe, and then he puts that in the mouth of somebody who hasn't said anything so far, but he puts those words in his mouth. He believes that's what he thinks. But the most common example of that the Muslim faces, at least from the aggressive missionary activity, is that, remember, if I'm talking about Christianity, that covers a wide range of kinds of people, and I'm talking now about one particular type of Christian. There is one particular type of Christian who makes a great deal out of saying, what I do cannot save me. I am saved by what I believe. What I do means nothing. What I believe means everything. I am saved by faith and not by works. That type of person very often tends to think, well, now what's the opposite of that? He thinks, if I'm saved by what I believe and not what I do, well, then the Muslim must think he's saved by what he does, not what he believes. He thinks his works are going to save him. And so they put those words in the mouth of the Muslim. They say, you people, you think that you're saved by how hard you work. And before you know it, unfortunately, most Muslims will try and defend that. What's happened is somebody has told the Muslim what he believes, and he starts to defend it without stopping to think, do I really believe that? This man told me that's what I believe. You see, in Islam, to start with, nobody gets saved. Now that will probably bother people who are very concerned about being saved, but it doesn't say anywhere in the Quran anybody gets saved. Muslims are not trying to get saved. That is a particular concept that comes from a certain group of churches. They say, look, there's only two choices. You're lost or you get saved.
He talks about that so much,
that gets to be the only thing the Muslims ever heard, and he starts to believe it too. Yes, it's lost or saved. The Quran doesn't say that. The Quran talks about people being lost. And what's the opposite of lost in the Quran? What's the different thing from being lost? It's being successful. Nothing about being saved. Being successful. It means you have a degree of success. You can have more of it and more of it and more of it, depending on the circumstances. But you can be lost or you can be successful. Maybe a little bit, maybe a great deal. That's the contrast in Islam. And that's what eliminates the confusion on the part of the Muslim that may cause some trouble for the non-Muslim, because this is what some people have done. If they think that you are saved or lost, then they say there are only two situations that are going to happen. If you're saved or lost, it means you have a reward or a punishment. And that's not a Muslim idea. Nobody is waiting to die so he gets reward or punishment. It's this. If it's not that, it's this. Islam doesn't teach that. It tells you instead, every man is rewarded for the good he did. Everybody, the non-Muslim, the worst of the unbelievers, the enemies of Islam, are rewarded for the good they did. Nobody suffers any injustice. If you did good, you get a reward. If you did bad, you get a punishment. But the punishments and the rewards match the good and the bad. As a matter of fact, the rewards are many times bigger than the good done. But the punishments match the wrong. The punishments fit the crimes. See, the difficulty that some groups of people are in is that they make reward equal salvation. That is, if you say to them, what is your reward for the good you did? They say, paradise. That's not an Islamic idea. Paradise is a reward. Some people get that reward. Some people get other rewards. But when you make reward equal paradise, then you're left in that situation to say, either this man gets the total punishment or he gets the total reward. There's nothing in between. Islam says anybody does even an atom's weight of good, well, then he will get something back for that. Most often, I suspect that the good people do, or whatever they do, they get the reward right here in this life. Or they tell you what they want as a reward, and they may get that too. Somebody told me one time, he was a minister, had his own church. I'd given a talk about who is Jesus and so on. He came to me after and he said, I've written a book about what you said. He said, and you're absolutely right. He said, if the church doesn't accept what you said, in 100 years the church will be dead. He says, I've predicted it in a book I've written. And some of the Muslim brothers are standing around, they heard this, and they're so surprised. They said, well, then why aren't you a Muslim if you agree with him? He said, oh, well, no, I'm not really interested in that. But I've written a book about the subject. And someday, long after I'm dead, people will know that I'm right. And I said, yes, and then what will they do? Will they build a big monument over your grave where you're buried? And his eyes lit up. He said, maybe. That's all he wants. He'll probably get it. He did a good thing. He wrote a book. He told the truth. But if you ask him, what reward do you want? He'll tell you, I'd like him to build a big marker where I'm buried. Well, probably he'll have that. So, nothing. No injustice will be done. That's his reward. He'll get his reward. Myself, I'd rather have a shady tree to sit under in paradise as my reward. So I hope you see the difference that I'm talking about. Punishments have to fit the crime. It cannot be a case of, well, everybody who falls into a category of being bad in any way, he gets the same punishment. We don't go to court that way. We don't have the death penalty for everything from running a red light to strangling your grandmother, the punishments fit the crimes. In court, in Islam, it's the same idea. Now let me tell you another experience that relates to this. It may seem that a Muslim could explain all of this information to somebody and try to get it across to him, and then he will understand Islam. It's not that easy. Very often it won't help a bit. It still won't help somebody understand Islam because of mental difficulties. There's an interesting verse in the Quran that says, maybe the best way you can put it in English is to say, it's speaking of unbelievers, in some cases it says, Allah knows when they hear with what they hear. Meaning, it's going into the ears and it gets to the brain, but they don't really hear what is being said. They're hearing with something else than what you usually use to hear with. So that even if the right words go in, somehow it gets distorted by the time it's processed, by the time it goes through the thinking centers, and they didn't hear what was said. You see, last year was one of these arrangements in Pennsylvania where a Christian group had invited the Muslims to have a debate, and so the brothers had told them just a few days before this get-together that the speaker's name is Gary Miller. And they said again, that's not fair. Brothers said, what do you mean it's not fair? He said, no, we want a Muslim. He said, he's a Muslim. It made them very nervous. So at the last possible minute, they thought they'd counteract the effect of having a North American talk about Islam, and they brought in an Egyptian Christian. So there was a Canadian talking about Islam, and here's an Egyptian talking about Christianity. He made all the mistakes that they were hoping I would make, as it happened. They really did. They came to the Juma the next day, the organizers of this thing, and they apologized to the Muslims for the performance of their speaker. But what I'm talking about is not being able to hear. It's on videotape, the evidence for what I'm saying. I would speak, and this man would speak, then I spoke, then he spoke. When I spoke, he's sitting there in front of us. And I said, usually what people will tell you is that Muslims do not admit that they are sinners. They won't admit that they're sinners. So this man will tell you that in a few minutes when he's standing here and speaking. Now he's sitting right there. I said, but I'm telling you right now, I am a Muslim, I am a sinner. I have sinned, I expect I probably will again. I am a sinner, and I'm a Muslim, and I'm saying that. But this man will tell you in a few minutes that no Muslim will say that. Now he's sitting there, looking him in the eye. 5 minutes later, he got up behind the microphone, and that's what he said. He said, no Muslim will admit that he's a sinner. This is the problem with you Muslims. My turn to speak again. I got up, and I said, I told you he would say that. I want to repeat, I am a Muslim, I have sinned, I probably will sin again. All Muslims do. This man will probably tell you again that no Muslim will say that. A few minutes later, he stood up to speak and he said it again. No, I don't know if he didn't hear me or not. He spoke English, not very well, but he was that close. But you see, this wisdom in this verse, this ayah in the Quran, Allah knows when they hear with what they hear. Are their ears really connected to the brain, or is something in the way, in between, that's messing up the information as it comes in? The reason he would insist on something like that is because to that particular philosophy, that's what makes them different from everybody else. They'd like to tell you. They want to tell you, we are the only human beings who admit that we are sinners. If somebody else admits he's a sinner, that ruins their whole plan. So they refuse to hear it when somebody says that. You see, this subject of sin is an old issue that has been debated right down to today. Some people will tell you even today we're not finished debating it yet because they realize the problem they have, at least in, say I'm not picking on Christianity, I'm just talking about what I'm familiar with. In most Christian churches, they have a problem that way. Because if you'll think about it carefully, what is it that they would tell the Muslim? that tell you, you people will be punished because no one has paid the price for your sins. Someone has to be punished for your sins. Jesus was, but you won't accept it. Someone has to be punished for every sin. Someone pays the price. And a few minutes later, they'll be telling you about how merciful their God is. They'll say, our God is forgiving, he forgives. And they don't seem to see that those are two different things. And you can have one or the other, but you can't have both. If you forgive, then you don't get paid. If you get paid, you don't forgive. Those are opposite meanings. They exclude one another. The Lord's Prayer, which is often recited, attributed to Jesus, includes a phrase where he says, pray this way. Say to God, forgive us our sins or our debts, as some translate it, the way we forgive those who sin against us, or the way we forgive those who owe us a debt. How do you forgive a debt? If this man owes me money and I forgive it, I say, you know the money you owe me, you were supposed to pay me today? It's forgiven. That means I don't get any money. If I say to him, you know the money you were supposed to give me today? Let's have it. And he gives it to me and I put it in my pocket and I say, oh, the money? The debt is forgiven. He didn't really get forgiven. He paid me. You can't have both. And as many times as people try to tell you a way that you can have both, you can be sure there's a mistake in there somewhere. There's a story going around now. It's been in use for 2 or 3 years. I know the man who invented it. Is still struggling to explain how you can forgive and get paid. He tells you, well, once there was a judge in the traffic court and a young woman was brought in front of him and she was found guilty of some traffic offense and he fined her. And then he finished the court proceedings and he stepped down from behind the bench, he took off his robes and he stepped over and he paid her fine for her. Because he was her father and he loved her and he forgave her. Well, that sounds like a nice story, but it still doesn't work. The law was offended, that is the state, the government was sinned against, and the state got paid. It doesn't matter who paid, the state got paid. The state didn't forgive her. Her father forgave her, but her father forgave her as her father, not as the state. He took off his robes. Court is over. He's not the state anymore. Now he forgives her. If he still had his robes on, court is still in session, and he says you are forgiven, it means nobody pays a fine. So no matter how many times people try and tell you a better story than that, there's a mistake in there somewhere. You cannot be satisfied for a debt and yet forgive a debt. It's one way or the other, or neither way, but it can't be both ways. That, of course, is not the first time I've ever explained that to anybody. I've been saying that since, I don't know, many years. And believe it or not, I've heard from some people, after they hear all of that, they'll say something like this. They even put it in this word, these words. I've heard people say, well, it's true. You see, God would like to not have anybody pay for sins. He'd like to forgive all the sins. But he can't. You see, on what basis can he do it? You see, the sin has piled up a big debt. It has to be paid off. So God has to make some arrangement to pay that. He'd like to forgive, but somebody's got to look after this debt. Well, the problem with that is they're not talking about the God I know about anymore. When I say God, or I say Allah, wrapped up in the definition is this is somebody who never lacks anything. He doesn't find himself in a situation where he's thinking, I'd like to do this, but I don't have everything I need. I'll have to get it from here. Oh, now I can do it. That's not God you're talking about. Somebody else. That's the way everything else works. But now and then, we, or whatever beings there may be, would like to do something and they don't have what they need, so they reach from here and they get it. But when you talk about the God, you're talking about someone who does not need anything. Everything is his. That's a part of the meaning of the Arabic attribute al-samad, the self-sufficient, or the source of all things, al-samad. And what happens when you explain that to people? You tell them what I've just said. You say, well, look, God doesn't need anything. He has what he needs. He doesn't have to make special arrangements to look after problems. In fact, if you quote to them the ayah of the Quran, as it says several times, it says, God forgives whom he chooses. They'll put words in your mouth because it's how they hear it. They say, oh, your God is arbitrary. He forgives whoever he likes. See, to them, when they hear that phrase, God forgives whom he chooses, it makes them think of a human being who he looks over a crowd of sinners and he says, well, I'll forgive this one and this one, but not this one. I don't like his looks. And this one, no, wait, I changed my mind. I will forgive this one, but not this one. That's what it means to them when they hear God forgives whom he chooses. That's not the meaning of that phrase. Wrapped up in the meaning of that is the thing I was just talking about. It means nothing prevents God from forgiving. He forgives whom he chooses. Nobody can say, wait, before you try to forgive that one, look, you haven't thought of this. Or you can't because, look, he forgives whom he chooses. He doesn't choose like we decide what we're going to have for dessert tomorrow night or something. As a matter of fact, the Quran tells us you can be sure of that. It talks about the sunnah of Allah. The sunnah of Allah. That means the characteristic behavior, the habit of Allah. And it reminds you that it never changes. It is completely consistent. It's not arbitrary. What he does is what he always does. Given the exact same set of circumstances, he will do the same thing every time. His sunnah is invariable. It's not arbitrary. So, having talked a great deal about sin and all that sort of thing, which I say it bothers some people very much, what usually happens is, instead of giving an answer to some of these difficulties, or adding up everything I've said and trying to talk about that, people usually start trying to find out, why did you say that? They start looking for your motives. People say, no, look, the reason you've said all that is because, and then they've got a whole list of different things. It doesn't really matter why I say it. It still needs to be answered. You see, even if the devil tells you something, it isn't an excuse to say, I don't have to answer you, you're the devil. No, if somebody raises a question, then you have to reply to it. You have to do something about it. You're supposed to confront false with truth. But instead, people look for motives. I was invited one time to speak to a Bible school in central Canada, or the prairies in Manitoba. And I talked about a lot of things, and when it was finished, the teacher took me aside, and we're standing out in the hall, and he talked about still more things, and I raised still more difficulties, and finally, instead of, nobody has replied to anything. He says, well, I think, you see, what your problem is that probably you had some good Christian friends, and then some of them turned out to not be very good friends. They did wrong to you or something. They annoyed you, or they bothered you, or they hurt you, and so you left them when you looked for somebody else. It's all right out of his imagination. He doesn't know me from anywhere. I said to him, well, as a matter of fact, probably the closest friends I ever had were Christians, and I miss them very much. They live a long ways away now. But we never had a fight. Good friends. In fact, I imagine they'd be glad to see me again. I'd be glad to see them. And he got all worried about this. Well, then what is the reason that you say the things you say? You see, his problem is he's looking for a motive instead of answering a question. So don't be put off by that kind of thing. If you raise a question, it deserves an answer. It doesn't deserve somebody telling you why they think you said what you said. You said it because you want an answer. I mention that experience because it's related to a similar kind of situation that happens very, very often, and probably there's a lot of you who have heard the very thing. you get into some discussion with the missionary, he will usually tell Muslims that your problem is you don't understand things. So the reason you're misguided is you don't understand. In particular, say you're talking about what is God, is he three or is he one? And if the Muslim says, no, you can't say God is three, that's wrong, the missionary will often say, no, look, the problem with you Muslims is you don't understand the Trinity. You think we have three gods. No, we have one God, but he's three. Your problem is you don't understand the Trinity. If you understood it, then you'd be a Christian. Remember that a person says that when they say that, because they do. It may happen within a few minutes, or it may happen in a couple of days, but the same person will tell you, if you ask him, could you explain the Trinity to me? They will tell you, no one understands it. You see his problem? He said to you, you see, if you Muslims understood the Trinity, you'd be Christians. Your problem is you don't understand it. Within 5 minutes, he'll probably tell you, no one understands it. I don't know how he thinks you're supposed to understand it. It just shows, I mean, there's a, you know, it's a two minds in one head. You see, he's telling you this, and then he becomes somebody else, and he tells you that. And the two things don't match up. Usually in aggressive missionary work, there are those who will tell the Muslims, your Quran says a lot of things about God as one, and it speaks against different things like worshiping three gods and calling it one, or saying that Christ is one-third of God and all these things. I say that, and all of that's true. See, your book doesn't actually describe the Trinity as it really is. It talks about other versions of the Trinity, the ones we don't even believe in. So the problem is the Trinity is not really mentioned in the Quran. The real Trinity is not mentioned in there. And if you ask him, well, how does the real Trinity go? He starts giving you an elaborate explanation. He said, no, see, the real Trinity works like this. And it will take him, as I say, it'll take him that many words to explain to you what the real thing is supposed to be like. And when he gives you all these words and all this vocabulary to explain the Trinity, he'll say, you see, now the Quran doesn't say that, so the real Trinity's not in there. The problem is, it doesn't say that in the Bible either. I mean, he said so many words, you can't find those words in the Bible. You took a scissors and cut out every word in the Bible one piece at a time and then took tape and glued it all together, you still couldn't make it say that. Those words aren't even in there. So he's made his own problem just bigger. Now again, remember, I'm talking about a certain type of person. You've got a great many people who see it otherwise, who are quite honest within the churches. Just within the last few months, the leading intellect in the Catholic Church, Hans Küng, and this is sort of the brains of the Catholic Church for a generation. Just recently, he finished studying the Quran. You know what he said about it? He said, God has spoken to man through the man Muhammad. It's the brains of the Catholic Church. There are honest people within the church. So don't think I'm down on everybody. I get Christian ministers who come to me sometimes and they say, can you give me the name and address of the person who said that thing that you mentioned? Because I want to go tell him he's wrong. Some people do care about the truth. Well, maybe more generally, how do people misunderstand Islam? Instead of talking about maybe some technical details or something. Often the reason that Islam is misunderstood is because, again, of the impression it gives people, it looks like something they don't think religion should look like. To give an example, it bothers a lot of people very much when they, if it ever comes to their attention, as it often does, that usually in any translation of the Quran, you'll find written on the same page, within about that much space on the page, instructions about prayer and instructions about using the toilet. That really bothers them. Because, you know, well, prayer is holy, but the toilet, what's that doing in a holy book, you see? It's because they've got this idea that somehow the world is horrible and evil, and we've got to leave it, if at all possible. So anything that seems to combine godly things and worldly things is disgusting. To the spiritually minded person, he'll tell you Islam is too materialistic. And to the materialistic minded person, he'll tell you Islam is too spiritual. Well, that's what makes it different, because the Muslim lives in the real world. The world can cause you a lot of trouble. There's a lot of evil in the world. As a matter of fact, God made it. He made that evil that's in the world. But he made the world, so the whole thing is good. He told you about the parts that you should watch out for. As an example, I mean, you may have a bush and it's got bright red berries growing on it. If a man eats those berries, he gets sick and dies. But if a bird eats those berries, he gets fat and healthy. So it's evil for the man and it's good for the bird. The things that are not good for man are the kinds of things the Quran warns us about. Like, stay away from this, it's not good for you. Well, but it's there for a good reason. So the world is good. Just be careful. You live in it. And your reward, what it is you're trying to gain, is supposed to be something like what you're familiar with now. If you know how pleasant it is to sit in the shade under a tree, maybe put your feet in the water and eat a piece of fruit, well, the Quran says that's something like what your reward is in paradise. You'll have a shade tree and a piece of fruit, your feet in the water. Only when you eat that piece of fruit, you'll say, this reminds me of the fruit I used to eat. But it's so different. More special. In a way that we probably can't imagine. But the point of it all is, what you do now, what you're trying to establish now, is something like what you hope you'll get. Your activity is related to the finished goal. See, in this way, Islam doesn't always function like a religion to most people's minds. To give an example, I mentioned the other night in Colombo, Islam prohibits intoxicants, or usually you'd consider alcohol or drugs or whatever, but Islam prohibits alcohol. Does it do that in a religious way? Well, it doesn't. It doesn't function like a religion when it prohibits alcohol. Not drinking alcohol is not a religious duty. It's functioning like a science. If you ask any doctor, say, would I be better off if I gave up drinking alcohol? He'll tell you yes, as a matter of fact. See, that's not a religious thing. It's a sensible, it's a good, it's a practical thing. The religion, if you will, Islam is functioning like a science. It's telling you something that a lot of other people know. It's not some sacred, hidden secret. It's reminding you, don't forget this, because if you'll take a careful look, you'll see it's true. You shouldn't intoxicate yourself. And many other things. If it tells you don't eat this, it's because it's not good for you, not because it's holy and you shouldn't touch it, or it's filthy and you shouldn't touch it. It's filthy in the sense that it'll hurt you. Let somebody else eat it. Let some other creature, or let it do whatever function it has. But human beings, you shouldn't eat this. You shouldn't drink that, and so on. It's acting like a science, not as a religion, where some things are forbidden and some things are commanded without any reason, except that they're somehow holy or unholy. What that means, I suppose, if you want to present Islam or make it look attractive to somebody, is that you can try to tell them that whether you believe what I believe or not, I still have a recipe here or a method which makes me successful, it makes me healthy, it gives me good laws to live by. This is the kind of thing that has gone on, I can tell you lots of stories this way, it's gone on in science and in legal practice and in personal lives, where a lot of people have said they don't like Islam at all, but they know that the Muslims have a good idea about this or that or the other thing, so they want to find out more to see if they have any more good ideas. They're examining it for the value that it seems to have. I would hope that they continue that process and it reaches a point where they realize, where did all this come from anyway? And somebody said to me a couple of years ago, a young woman who kept coming after a series of lectures and want to argue about this or that, and I talked a great deal about the content of the Quran, and finally she said to me, okay, you convinced me. The man who wrote that book, she figures the prophet of Islam, the man who wrote this book, she says, okay, he was a genius. Because this is brilliant. Doesn't mean he was a prophet. So I just remind her, it was the last thing I said to her. This was in the Emirates. She happened to be staying there. She was Chinese. But I said, you're telling me the man is a genius? You're convinced he's brilliant? She says, yes, because of all these different things. I said, but remember, the man himself said that this didn't come out of his head. He said an angel gave it to him. I said, was he a genius when he said that? Or was he crazy? She had to think about that. A couple of months went by and somebody telephoned me from the Emirates. He was talking about something else and then he happened to mention, he says, oh, by the way, do you remember that woman who you talked with? I said, she accepted Islam last night. Went around in her mind for about 30 days, I guess, realizing that if the man's a genius, but he said he used to talk to an angel, I have a problem trying to figure out how can that be so. But that really is another story which we talked about the other night in Colombo under the title of The Amazing Quran, and maybe some of that information, and there's a great deal more can be made available to you. We concluded that talk by trying to say that if somebody insists that Muslims are misguided, the Muslim should follow the advice of the Quran. What does it tell us about when people say things? It tells us over and over again, whatever anybody says, it tells us, tell him to bring his proof. If he says it, make him show it. Don't just let him say it, but ask him to show you that that's true. Don't just keep telling me, show me. That applies in everything. So if somebody said, you Muslims are misguided, you want to ask, can you show me one thing that is a misguidance? Can you prove to me that this is right, but I am wrong? Show me where I have been deceived. If somebody says the Quran is a book of lies, tell them, show me one lie. Just one lie. You said it's full of lies, show me one. And be careful, because what people will usually do, they will fool themselves. They will show you maybe something in the Quran that they don't like or something they disagree with, but what you ask them was, show me a lie. Show me something which the whole world knows is true. No one will argue, but in the Quran, it says something different. Show me a lie, not something you don't like, or something different than what it says in your book, unless you can prove your book is right. A lie is what you're looking for. If Muslims are misunderstood, and they certainly are, it is by at least three different reasons. It's either by accident, that people misunderstand but they don't mean to, or they are misunderstood deliberately. People mean to misunderstand them, that is, some people make sure that Islam is misunderstood, or it could be our own fault that we're misunderstood. To give an example of each of these three things, people may be misunderstood Muslims may be misunderstood by accident, because there's hardly a week goes by, at least in Canada, that there won't be some silly newspaper article that says something about Islam or the history of Muslims which simply isn't true, but it says so. Just a few weeks ago, Toronto Sun told us all that, in the first place, it started off in one article by telling us that Ramadan was the month of pilgrimage, which shows how much research they did. But an article goes on to say that once upon a time there were 600 Jews who, they were very nice people, but Muhammad decided to cut all their heads off. So they didn't do anything wrong, but he killed them all, men, women, and children. Well, is that what happened? Was there such a situation? A lot of people believe that because it's in the newspaper. It's unfortunate. The man who wrote it probably believes it because he got it out of a book in the public library. But what a lot of people don't seem to realize is a lot of that stuff that's in the public library is a repetition of still older material which was originally false. But it's so old that people forget it started off as something false. You have the same thing going on today in many, many fields. Just recently, somebody had spoken up and he was talking about a certain episode that was supposed to have happened in World War II, so about 45 years ago, till it was brought to his attention that a few years ago, the British government officially said that report was made up. It was supposed to stir people up and make them angry so they'd be in a mood to go to war. It wasn't true. British government officially said that. Doesn't matter. Somebody else came across it somewhere. He doesn't realize it was later denounced as a lie, and he repeats it, and it'll probably be repeated for 100 years. The propaganda that was around Europe about the Muslims during the time of the Crusades was imaginary, but it's been passed down, and a lot of people still believe it. One Muslim has done a fine job of collecting a lot of this. He's documented all of these things and where the stories originated. He's collected a lot of Crusades material. You know, in the 13th century, the British used to be told that in Palestine, the Muslims have a giant statue of their prophet made of solid gold, and when a pigeon lands on it, the bird instantly dies. Well, that's what a lot of people believed about 700 years ago, and that's the kind of thing that was talked about then, and it has an effect right down to today, where people still think something strange about Muslims. One man recently said on radio in Canada, he's a well-known commentator, he's a writer of television programs, he's a journalist, very famous man. He recently said, having some discussion about warfare and so on, he says, do you know that the Muslim believes that if he's fighting for the sake of God and he's killed, he'll be rewarded? See, isn't that frightening? Isn't that stupid? What does the Christian believe? Something different? What does the Christian believe? You're asking me, if you're fighting in the way of God, you get killed, what happens? You get punished? Or do you have a reward? Tell you the same thing the Muslim will tell you. But somehow when you tell it that way and you make it sound scary, you forget. But you might say the same thing. That's more an example of the second thing I'm talking about, that Muslims are often misunderstood by intention. There are people who deliberately try to make it look bad. Sometimes they fool themselves, but they certainly fool a lot of other people. I don't know if you ever saw this thing that happened, it's been about 3 years ago, when the Queen of England visited Saudi Arabia. And there was a picture that ran in British newspapers, which some photographer took in Saudi Arabia. It was just a few days before the Queen got there. What happened was, there were some workers, about four or five Muslim workers at the airport, and it was time for prayer. Well, they were out, you know, in the open, the runway area, or out in the open. It's time for prayer, so they turn, they face Mecca, and they start to pray. It so happened that right in front of them was one of these stairways that they wheel up to the airplanes when people get off. Just happened to be in front of them, but they turned, they were facing that thing because that way is Mecca, and they started to pray. This photographer waited. He waited until they made ruku, until they were standing like that, facing the stairs, and he took that picture. And it ran in British newspapers saying, these were Muslims practicing to greet the Queen when she stepped off the plane. There's the stairs, this is how they bow. See how people are deliberately misled. That's a caption that ran into that picture. But unfortunately, often Muslims are misunderstood because of their own fault. One way that happens, I've already mentioned, is that too often today, Muslims are letting non-Muslims tell Muslims what Muslims believe. Sometimes, and it usually works. They'll say to the Muslim, you know, you people believe such and such and so. And this Muslim is thinking, I didn't know that. He says, and look, it's wrong, because. And he goes ahead and he blows it all away, shows why it's no good. And the Muslim is saying, what am I going to do now? When he didn't believe that in the first place, or he shouldn't have, it's not part of Islam. Somebody told him it was, and he thought it was, and now he sees it's no good. That's your own fault. For being that unaware of things, or ignorant, like an unkind word. People are letting them explain what Muslims believe. I meet people like that all the time, and when I respond, they don't like it at all. I've had people many times, they say, you know, you Muslims believe such and such. And I say, no, we do not. Yes, you do. I said, no, I'm a Muslim. I'm telling you, I don't believe that. You do. Because the rest of his argument won't work if I don't go along the way he wants me to go. So by way of advice, I suppose I could give a lot of advice. I need a lot of advice too, but I'm just suggesting some things that you might keep in mind. The Muslim's job is not to go to the non-Muslim and say, you should leave what you have and you should be a Muslim. That is not your job. It's not what you do when you talk about Islam to somebody. You say, look, you're wrong, this is right. Leave that, come here. That is not found in the Quran. What you find is a systematic way of leading people along. The Quranic plan works this way. It tells you, when you speak with a non-Muslim, you tell him, commit no excess in your religion. In other words, you tell him, you should be more careful about your own religion. You say this, you say that, but you don't have any proof. Leave it. Don't say that, but say the things for which you have proof, because I believe those too. You have proof, I should believe it. Commit no excesses in your religion. So it is that over many centuries, there have been people who have come to Islam, and when their families thought they'd lost their minds, they tried to explain to their families, no, no, you see, I'm a better whatever I used to be. There's a famous case of about 100 years ago of Lord Headley, a British nobleman. He accepted Islam, and his family thought he has gone crazy. And he wrote them a very nice letter, which is still in circulation today, where he explained to them, no, no, you see, by becoming a Muslim, I became a better Christian. Because I stopped doing the things which Christians are not authorized to do. And the next thing I knew, I was doing what I believed Jesus wanted me to do, and it happened to lead me here. You have as an example. If the reports are true, not my problem whether they're true or not, but people who believe all of the reports they have, what did Jesus say and do? It's reported that he told people, let your greeting to one another be, peace be with you. Who says peace be with you when they greet one another? Christians or Muslims? Muslims, whether they speak Arabic or not, they say, salam alaikum, peace be with you. It's reported Jesus used to fast for more than a month at a time. Who fasts, Muslims or Christians? It says in one place in the Bible, when he prayed, he put his head on the ground. Who prays like that with their head on the ground? Christians or Muslims? Who starts to look more like maybe this is the group that's following Jesus? That's just an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. So really, when you're talking to the non-Muslim, your goal is not to say, turn against what you have and take what I have. The first thing is, are you sure about all the things you do? Which of them can you prove? And you do better if you leave the things you can't prove and stick to the ones you can prove. Then see what kind of progress you make. The second point is restraint, I suppose. Think carefully about the kinds of things that people show you. As many people have said, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, intelligent people have thought about it, the greatest part of the debates that you get into with people are because you put today's meaning on yesterday's words. So that, for an example, the Muslim says, Jesus is not the Son of God. And the Christian says, look, it brings out the Bible and it reads Jesus, Son of God. And the Muslim says, somebody put that in there, it's a lie. No, it was probably there for 2,000 years. But what did it mean 2,000 years ago? See, when a man reads today, Son of God, capital S, it means to him a whole lot of things. But 2,000 years ago, what did it mean? Same source will tell you that one day the Jews came, they wanted to argue with Jesus. First thing they told him was, we're the sons of God. Jesus said, no, no, you're not the sons of God. I'm a son of God. You're the sons of the devil. Whatever he's talking about, he's not talking about what people talk about today when they mean sons of God, or sons of the devil, for that matter. It's a way of speaking in the language of the day to say, who looks after you anyway? Whose household do you belong to? Just as the Arabs still today talk about being a son of the desert. It don't mean anything literal, but it means they prefer the desert to somewhere else. The Bible talks about sons of perfume. It means people who made their living selling perfume. It's a figure of speech. But what happens is, people are trying to tell you, no, you see, Jesus meant what I mean today. Because look, when he said it, the Jews got angry. So they interpret the anger of the Jews. They don't keep reading long enough where he goes on to tell them that they're wrong to even be angry. Explains why even their anger is incorrect, because he didn't say what they thought he said, but people are not aware of that. So are Muslims misguided or misunderstood? I've suggested is a thing that Muslims ought to give right back to the people who have one opinion or the other. If people think Muslims are misunderstood, well, that's very good. That's a healthy attitude. But if people think Muslims are misguided, the Muslim's job is to say, why do you think that? Can you show me where I'm misguided? And then maybe the discussion can turn around to where the Muslim might say, as for you, if you are misguided, it's because you don't understand. In other words, the same thing that they used to tell you. Only now you are supposed to be equipped to show them what they don't understand. Your excuse is not going to, you're not going to have an excuse like they had. If you can see the situation. Remember I mentioned to you, some man might say, if you understood the Trinity, you'd be a Christian. And 5 minutes later he says, no one understands it. You're not going to be in that situation. You might say to someone, if you only understood that God is one, but you're not going to be in a situation of a few minutes later saying, how he can be one, I can't understand, it's crazy. Not crazy, it's the only thing that makes any sense. You should be ready to explain that kind of thing. May Allah bless and reward our efforts. Thank you for your time and attention.
If there is any in the audience who wish to pose any questions, pose any question to the speaker, he or she may do so.
Can I ask you a question which may be personal, but which I'm sure the answer to which will enlighten us and will give us a better understanding of all that you have said this afternoon? My question to you, brother, is when did you first get to know about Islam, and when in your life did you decide to accept, to embrace Islam?
I started out, I don't go around giving testimonials and telling you the wonderful story of how I became a Muslim. So I don't really want to do that, but it's a dull story anyway. Nothing fantastic happened. No Muslim ever stepped up to me and said, I bet you never heard this before, and he said some magic words and said, my God, I should be a Muslim. But it didn't happen that way, and I don't think it ever happened to anybody that way. Just a matter of, for about 15 years, I'd been doing a lot of investigating of a lot of things. Didn't have anything to do with Islam under the name Islam, just investigating things. And one day, I thought, I'll read the Quran and see how much is any good. And about 3 days later, I realized, well, this book says what I've been saying for 15 years, so I guess I must have been a Muslim since a long time ago. Then I went to find some Muslims. That was in 1978, so that's, to cut the long story short, that's about the way it happened. I was asking for more clarification on that thing that I was talking about, the difference between hearing and processing the information. Maybe I can go over it another time or try to show you what I'm getting at. See, there's an ayah in the Quran which I have never seen properly translated into English. It talks about a man who was guilty It says because he heard something. And then it says he got up and he didn't saddapa. And every English translation says he got up, he went away, and he didn't give any coins in charity. He didn't give alms. He didn't practice charity. That's not the meaning of that word in that place. That's a form of saddaka. It's got a double dial in the middle. That saddaka means he didn't check on it. He didn't make sure it was true. Just as we say you finish recitation of the Quran, saddaka Allahu al-Azim. You're saying, so truthfully said Allah, the Almighty. It's a form of that word, saddaka. So it tells you, you are guilty of a crime if you hear something, and then you just leave it go. You don't check to see if it's a true thing that you heard. So you're supposed to digest everything. What you hear, you're responsible for. You're supposed to sort out the true from the false, from another category, which might be you don't know if it's true or false, so save it. You have no right to reject it, you have no right to accept it. Save it till you can find out. That's what you're supposed to do with saddaka, check on the truthfulness of it. So it is when you, if you're not in the habit of doing that, then some of the circuits aren't working up here. So that you can hear words that people speak, they come in, but somehow the brain doesn't do everything with them it's supposed to do. So you don't really hear what's being said. You might even be able to repeat the exact words back, but you don't really know. You don't hear what's going on. The Quran talks about people with ears, but they can't hear. It's not talking about deaf people in the usual sense. All the noise goes in, but the sense doesn't penetrate because they've disconnected the circuits. The brain works something like machinery. If you work with the computers, you might know if you've got an elaborate piece of machinery, a computer, you could step around behind it and maybe cut one wire. There's maybe thousands of wires or whatever, printed circuits and so on. Maybe make one disconnection. The machine will still work. Probably work very fine almost every day. But every once in a while, it will do something foolish. It will spit out some garbage because you ruined it somehow, you disconnected something. So when you tamper with a brain, you disconnect some little thing that's supposed to be working there. It'll work most of the time, but every once in a while it does something really foolish. So I hope that clarifies somewhat what I'm getting at there.
What is your point of view on Christianity? What can you tell us about Jews? Very wide ranging questions. And then another one, question number one. What made you change to a Muslim?
Viewpoint on Christianity. Well, look, that's the subject of two lectures later this week. But to put it to you, maybe the simplest way I know how, anyone who calls himself a Christian already has a problem. Because Jesus never used that word. If you ask an Arabic-speaking person today, you say to him, well, how do you say Christian in Arabic? What do you call those people? They'll tell you, Masaheen, the Messiah people, the Messiahists. Because Messiah means Christ, the Christ people. But what does the Quran call the followers of Jesus, the real followers of Jesus? It doesn't say Masaheen, it says the Nasara. Now, if you look very carefully in the Bible, you won't find many people that know it, but it's in there in the 11th chapter of the book of Acts. It tells you it was after the time of Jesus that the name Christian was given to these people as a nickname. The non-Christians heard they're always talking about Christ. Those are the Christ people. But the only thing you ever find applied to the people who knew Jesus or applied to himself was, they used to say, the Nazarene or the sect of the Nazarenes. So already when you say Christian, you have a problem. Maybe you belong to the wrong club. Some Christians realize that. That's why I say you can't say one thing that covers all Christians. There's even some Christians who say we shouldn't use that word. Jesus didn't. If we want to follow him, we should leave that. So that's the beginning of a very big subject. As to Jews, what the Quran has to say about Jews, as far as if you want to say that if Christians do this or this group does that and so on, what do Jews do that Muslims complain about? What does the Quran speak against Jews for? In the first place, it doesn't speak against all Jews automatically, but it says there is a thing that some Jews do that's wrong. It's the complaint against Jews, and that is, it says that they have the laws of God, but they keep them to themselves. It's the kind of thing, there are some Jews who protest about it. The Bible, the so-called the Jewish portion of the scripture, is full of laws like, don't eat meat which has blood in it. But if you have some bloody meat, sell it to the foreigner. Let him eat it. That's the kind of thing that the Muslim or Islam has against the Jews. To say, if God gives you a law, then it's not just for you, so you can let the other man do the bad thing. Some Muslims act just like that. Telling the brothers earlier today, I met a so-called Muslim who told me, I don't drink alcohol, I'm a Muslim. I keep lots of alcohol in my home. When my non-Muslim friends come, I pour them a drink. That's really silly. And that's the kind of thing that the Quran talks about regarding the Jews, that if you have a God-given law, then you don't split up how you observe it this way. As to the third point, what makes you change? Well, you see, again, I don't think I've ever met anybody who became a Muslim because there was something that happened like that and said, I should change. It's a process of time. You realize this is true and that's true and the other is true, and one day you realize, well, if all of this is true, really I'm standing in the wrong place. I should be standing over here. It's not necessarily one thing that's brought up. There may be one last thing that comes up. Maybe there's one last foolish thing a person hears and realizes, that does it, that's enough. Because when I add that to this and this and this, I realize I'm in the wrong place. But it's not like there's one thing that does it.
How does some man speak?
Actually, where you can find out all of this information, and maybe this is one way that you can try and, it's one way that you may reach the Christian. The information about what does the Bible say Father, Son, and Spirit is in Christian books. See, the truth is there. It doesn't really do you much good if you come to a Christian and say, I've got a book here, it's written by whatever, Imtiaz Mustafa, and it tells you about Christianity. He doesn't care. But if you can go to him and say, do you know this book, which your church prints, says this, and you can show him a thing or two, then maybe you make some progress. Because there's all kinds of opinions, but the documentation is there for such things as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and so on. What do they mean? Some churches will tell you right out, no problem. They'll put it right in print. They say there's nothing in the Bible that has anything to do with Trinity. The Catholic Church will tell you that. They say there's nothing in the Bible that teaches the Trinity. They'll tell you that officially. Most Catholics won't agree, but officially, that's what the church said. So if you're armed with that kind of thing, you can show that to somebody and at least reopen the discussion. Show them that what they're saying won't even be supported by the church. So that's one way of approaching it. And it's following that Quranic advice. You're telling somebody, don't exceed your authority. You want to be a good whatever? Look, here's what the official position is. Now, of course, that won't work if you've got some church who doesn't care about honest scholarship investigating things, who will print whatever they like to suit them. It won't work. You have to have other approaches. You have to show people perhaps where they've been told an untrue thing. And there's many, many examples of that kind of thing. You know, one came up the other night. There's a common thing that people will tell you. They'll say, the Bible is finished. There's no revelation after the Bible. Because look here, on the last page of the Bible, it says, let no one take from this book or add to this book, or he'll be cursed. Do you see this? On the last page of the Bible, it says that. People say that very often. What they also know, or at least their leaders know and will tell them, is if you ask them, this last page of the Bible, was it the last page written in the Bible? They'll tell you, no, as a matter of fact, there were three books that were written later, but they're put in ahead of that book. Well, if that sentence means the Bible's finished or the revelation is finished, nothing comes after this, how did these books written a few years later get stuck in ahead of that? Then they'll tell you, oh, well, you see, that doesn't mean that. That means it's talking about this little book, this last number 66, means this book is finished. Don't add to it or don't take from it. That's true. That's probably what it means. But that's what they should have told you the first time. It's what they'll tell you after you expose that this first argument doesn't work. So if you see what I'm getting at, you might in this way show somebody that he has been fooled. There are many examples of that kind of thing. I have a man who, he hates Islam, but he's helping me very much, thank you, with all the things he does. Because he keeps telling his students things about Islam, and his students come to me, and I tell them the same thing I told him years ago. I say, that argument came from such and such a man, and this is what I told him, and they will agree with me. So then I ask them, why do you suppose he told it to you when he knows better? And in that way, at least they start to understand maybe they trusted the wrong man to teach them from true from false. But anyway, that's a very big subject. how best do you reach people? And I can just suggest a few things. The other thing that it's not necessarily what you say, remember, it's what you do. Act as you're supposed to act, and people can be impressed. I guess in the last 2 years, a man in Toronto was telling me, he was from Yugoslavia, and he said this story had come to him from a friend in Yugoslavia, where Muslims and Christians had lived side by side for hundreds of years, and there was a Christian man who was in his 70s. All his life he lived on the same piece of ground, and he grew grapes, and he sold grapes. And he had a Muslim customer who'd been buying grapes from him for 50 years. And one day this old Christian man said, something's wrong. It took him 50 years to figure it out. But he said, you know that Muslim man? He comes here to buy grapes from me all the time. But if he's here and it's time for prayer, he excuses himself and he prays. He doesn't drink. He doesn't throw his garbage in the street. He puts it in the waste can. And when he walks, he takes care that he doesn't step on an ant. My church tells me he's going to burn in hell. Says me, I pray sometimes. I drink. I throw my garbage in the street. I step on ants. I step on cats and dogs. My church tells me I'm going to heaven. Something's wrong. Well, it took him 50 years to figure it out. But the Muslim was giving dawah. He was telling the man about this for 50 years, but just acting like a Muslim. Might not have been anything he ever said, but he acted like a Muslim. Finally, the message got across to this man. Somebody's trying to fool me. Somebody's told me something that doesn't add up. Sorry.
Question number one, was there any movement that led you to Islam? Question number two, what were the objections you had when you became Muslim?
So was there any movement that led you to Islam? No, I said I never met any Muslims until I realized that Islam was true. Then I went to find some Muslims. As a matter of fact, the first Muslim I met was a man who was sitting in the mosque. I'd looked up in the telephone book to find where there was a mosque, and I went over and I pushed open the door and just stuck my face in, and there was a man sitting there doing some writing, sitting on the floor, or on a chair, but he was writing on his lap. And he just threw his books and papers in the air, and he just came running over to me. And I found out later that this man was a university student, and he used to stay in the mosque as much as he could. He'd do his schoolwork in the mosque, and he had an apartment next door. He used to sit there as much as he could because he was looking for new faces. Why? Because he wanted to make sure that somebody who was newly interested in Islam was going to be approached by somebody with good sense instead of some idiot. That's why he ran to me. He wanted to get to me before some fool got to me. If it sounds unkind, it's true. A lot of really silly people who are waiting to supposedly welcome people to Islam. It happened recently in North America where one man was interested in Islam. He went to the mosque and he did like I did. He opened the door and somebody grabbed him and pulled him inside and said, shook him by the shoulders and said, say la ilaha illallah. Man says, what does that mean? He says, say it, la ilaha illallah. The man says, la ilaha illallah. Man grabs him and says, welcome to Islam, brother. The man doesn't know what he said. He doesn't know what's going on. He thinks, this man is insane. I'm getting out of here. A similar, many stories like that. I know an American woman who came to Islam, but first time she went to a mosque, somebody came running over to her and said, what are you doing here? She said, I came to find out something about Islam. He said, well, you have to go home and throw away your wine. First thing. Met people who said, in fact, this Steve Johnson, who used to be a Jesuit priest. He was scared to go into the mosque. He said he walked up and down on the street in front of it for a long time, and finally he went up and he opened the door and somebody came running over to him and said, are you clean? He says, I took a shower this morning. Well, it should be okay then. What do you want? There's all kinds of people who really make it difficult for the newly interested people in Islam. The first revelation was not throw away your wine or all these other things that people sometimes they want to start there. You know, answer a man's questions and bring them along. See, what next? You don't start with the whole thing. There's a group in New Zealand who stand guard at the mosque in Auckland, and when a New Zealander comes and he wants to know about Islam, they tell him, go away. It's not for non-Muslims, it's for Muslims. There was one New Zealander who insisted. He said, but I want to know about Islam. So they said, all right, come inside and make 17 rakat, and then maybe I'll tell you something. That goes on. What objections did you have? Yeah, I'm not sure what is meant by that. What opposition or something like that?
I mean, you were in the same society, you became a Muslim. And from the society that you live, did you have any special problems, that is, objection of changing?
No, not really.
Most people don't. Really, I think sometimes it seems Muslims have an idea. Sometimes they ask me, they say, what do you miss most about what you used to have now that you are a Muslim? Well, if there was something I missed, probably I'd still be there. You know, in other words, it's not like there's a whole lot of fun and wonderful things outside Islam, and when you become a Muslim, you really miss them. There aren't things like that, if you really know which things are worthwhile. As to family pressure, I didn't have any problem. My family is quite receptive. That's not always the case, but my wife had the biggest difficulty there. Her parents caused her a lot of grief for a time, and then they started to realize, well, she's different than she used to be, and we have grandchildren now, and it started to take effect. In fact, it finally reached a point after a couple of years. One day her mother said to her, the sun was about to go down. And her mother said, don't you have a prayer you're supposed to say before the sun goes down? My wife says, well, there's still time. She said, well, you don't want to miss it. See, that's a kind of very slowly the attitude changes. A lot of people go through that, but that's not always the case. Some people have a very hard time. Maybe you can explain what you mean here. Since you were to change all your Christian ideas, how do you solve them? How do you solve these difficulties? I think, yeah, maybe we've already kind of...
Problems. You would have had many, many problems.
No, not then. I'd been solving those for 15 years. So I used to engage, and it was like a hobby, I suppose, but I used to, in the business I was in, I'd go from city to city moving. And when I get to a new city, I'd take out the telephone directory, and I'd look up all the priests and ministers. And I'd give them a telephone call and say, would you mind if I came and talk to you? And of course, they're delighted, you see. So I'd go over and basically I'd be saying, why is it that you say this, but your own book says that? And I used to love to battle with them this way. So I was already fighting this battle. When I found out this is what Muslims believe, no problems. No, this is what I used to tell them all the time, so they didn't have to overcome some kind of a thing. But I would stress that there are a lot of things Muslims have to be understanding of new Muslims. Sometimes they carry a lot of ideas along with them which they can't help, and you've got to try and slowly try to show people, well, but your attitude is still back there, and the new attitude ought to be this, and you try and turn this thing around. An example is Islamic law. How does it work? Which things are good, which things are bad? Broadly speaking, the psychology is, in Christianity, if you're in doubt about something, it must be bad. Forbid it, basically speaking, because the world is evil. So if you're not sure if it's good or bad, it must be bad. In Islam, it works the other way. See, if your conscience tells you that you worry about doing it, well, then you ought to leave it. But when it comes to making a law about it, if you don't know, then it must be all right. Because whereas in Christianity, you have a short list of the things that are permitted, in Islam, you have a short list of the things that are forbidden. See, so if it's not on the forbidden list, well, it must be all right. Unless it's really spelled out or the matter is made very clear, then it must be permitted. At least it's not harmful to you. So sometimes people have still got the old attitude and they're in fear of a lot of things. And sometimes I remember hearing one man one time, it was explained to him about something. He'd been a Muslim for 2 or 3 years. And when something was explained to him, it was so exciting to him. He hit the floor like that. He says, "Now I believe." It was like he discovered Islam all over again today, because this was such a big jump from an attitude that he didn't realize he'd been carrying around like a heavy weight all his time.
You were a Christian before you embraced Islam, were you? You were a Christian before you embraced Islam, were you?
Yes.
As a Christian, you must have believed Jesus is Son of God. As a Christian,
yes.
You must have believed Jesus is Son of God. As Muslims, we believe he is also an apostle like Prophet Muhammad. How do you distinguish before embracing Islam? How do you get enlightenment that Jesus is Prophet, not a Son of God?
Okay, well, in the first place, not all Christians believe Jesus is the Son of God. And while I was raised, and all my education right through university was in Catholic schools, I left that because I didn't believe it since I was maybe 14. Didn't believe that and finished the rest of the education. So it wasn't, that was a thing I figured out when I was 14, okay? It's largely because of I used to get perfect grades on religious exams. And then one day it occurred to me, the reason that the grade is high is because every word on here is what the teacher said. I gave him back what he said. That's why he likes it. That doesn't mean it's true. It just means I remember what he said. It's time for the exam. I write it down and give it to him. He puts a big love note on my paper. Brilliant student. It's his words. No wonder he thinks it's intelligent. That's when it occurred to me that just because somebody explains it nicely doesn't mean it's true. So then, you know, many years after that, it's not a problem to set aside some kind of an idea, which I've set aside since a long, long time ago. Do you or did you believe that Jesus was crucified? Yes, I suppose at one time I used to think. I never tried to defend that because it just seemed to me it was never in dispute. I always thought, well, it must have been crucified. Who would say otherwise? But it came to my attention that, as a matter of fact, history will tell you that's in doubt, very much doubt. The Christian church will tell you it's in doubt. There's a standard book which is studied by virtually anybody who studies for the Christian ministry, Catholic or Protestant. If he studies to be a minister or priest, he studies J.N.D. Kelly's Early Christian Doctrine. So they all read it. And in that book, Early Christian Doctrine, it tells you, since the first century, there have been Christians who said Jesus wasn't crucified. When that kind of thing came to my attention, I realized, well, then it's not this neat, solid, airtight story that I've always heard, because even in their own information, they'll tell you it's been in doubt since the first time anybody talked about it. It's been in doubt within the Christian community. So that's when I started to re-examine that and look at it again. How does the Bible refer to the descending of Jesus in the future? Well, you'll get many different versions of that depending on which church you ask. A lot of them have different ideas about it. So You have to ask them what they think the Bible says about it. The Protestants fall into sort of two groups now. One group says, Jesus is coming just before the world ends to snatch away all of his friends, all of those who love him, and leave the rest of us here to have a terrible time. And another group says, no, no, we will all be here and have a terrible time. Then Jesus will come and take away the ones who love him. So I don't know if you see it in this country, but you see it a lot in the U.S. The people who believe that Jesus is coming just before the trouble starts, he's going to come and take away those who love him just before a big war breaks out, they put stickers on the back of their car, for example, telling you if you're driving behind him, you can read the sticker on his bumper. It says, watch out, the driver may disappear. It could happen any minute. Some of them will put a sticker inside the car on the passenger side. It's a warning to the passenger. It says, be ready to take the wheel if the driver disappears. So, some people believe that. Other people will laugh like you laugh. That's ridiculous. Muslims often quote this verse in the fourth surah about the crucifixion, and saying that the Jews said they killed the Messiah, but they didn't. So it was made to appear to them, and usually they stop quoting about there. Well, the verse goes on. They usually stop right there, and then they explain it. And they say, well, the Jews thought they killed Jesus, but what happened was they killed the wrong man. They killed Judas. Doesn't say that anywhere. Doesn't even say they killed the wrong man. Just says they thought they killed Jesus because that's what it was made to look like to them. Uses an Arabic word, the shabha, which in this sense, probably the best translated counterfeit. It means a crucifixion was counterfeited for them. So maybe they killed the wrong man. Maybe they killed Judas. Maybe they killed, as some Christians have said for 2,000 years, they killed not Judas, they killed Simon, the man who helped him carry the cross. They grabbed the wrong one at the last minute. They killed Simon. Simon said, no, wait, I'm the one who was helping him. Some Christians have said that. Or maybe they killed nobody. It was just an illusion. Some Christians have said, no, Jesus got away and he stood and he watched and there was nobody there, but it looked like there was somebody there. Who knows? If they keep reading that verse in the Quran, it says, if you, the Muslim, or anybody else, thinks you know what really happened, you have no foundation for it. You have nothing but conjecture. You're just as bad as them. What you know is, he wasn't crucified. It looked like a crucifixion, but they're wrong. If you want to say, well, it happened like this or it happened like that, according to this ayah, maybe it did, but you have no proof, so maybe you shouldn't say it. The reason that you get into a lot of discussion about this, and if I can defend somebody who has been picked on for it in his absence, is Ahmadinejad. He's written a great deal about this subject, but he never said, this is how it happened. He's tried to demonstrate that if the Bible is accurate, this seems to be how it happened. It's, in other words, he's saying to the people who believe in that book, this is your problem. Your own book says it didn't happen the way you said it happened. It happened in a way which is compatible with the Quran, that nobody got killed, that you thought he was dead, but he wasn't. But he hasn't said, this is what happened. It's possibly what happened. If God wants a son, who would he have taken as his son? Adam or Jesus? Why do I only get two choices? See, there's a verse in the Quran that tells us that if God wanted to adopt a son, he could have taken anyone he chose. Didn't even have to be a man. But there's an interesting thing about that verse. See, there's many ways that somebody can be a son. He could be born a son, or he could be adopted as a son. Different sorts of things can happen. But on the subject of adoption as a son, the Quran says, if Allah wished, he could choose whom he wanted. He could take, adopt whom he wanted as a son. But it goes on to say, the reason he doesn't is because it doesn't suit him. In other words, he can't because of who he is. He cannot adopt. That is, he could take who he wanted, but he can't because it is an ungodly thing to do. Something like saying, if you know a man who he's very pure, noble, and I might say to you, that man could never say a bad word. He couldn't curse somebody. And you might say, but he can. Look, he has all the equipment. He has the throat and the tongue and the teeth, the lips. He knows the words. He can speak. Don't tell me he can't say a bad word. I said, he can't.
because of the man he is. It's impossible for him to do it. So that's what the Quran is talking about here, saying, if you're talking about limiting God's ability, he could do it, but he can't do it because it's ungodly. If he did it, he wouldn't be acting like God. And the reason is this, among others, the Quran points out to us. Now and then, I don't know if you ever see it here, but maybe you'll see it in a newspaper story sometimes, there'll be some individual, Europe or North America, who will adopt legally, they say, a cat or a dog as their child. They write it up in the newspaper, and everybody has a big laugh. Man says, the dog is now my son. I adopted him. You see, I filled out all the papers. The dog has his own bedroom. He sits at the table and he eats with me. He has a scholarship to university. He has his own mailbox. All he thinks is, the dog is my son. And everybody thinks, so ridiculous. Well, why is it ridiculous? It's ridiculous because man and dog are different kinds of things. And a man can call a dog a son, he can treat it like a son, he can do all the things that fathers do to sons, but the dog can't act like a son. It's not human. It doesn't know how to behave like a son. It cannot respond like a son. The only way to adopt a dog and really have him be a son is you've got to make him a little bit human. But now he's not a dog anymore. He's a four-legged man. You have to give him a little humanity. Now he can really be a son or something. Same thing goes if you talk about God adopts somebody as a son. God is this kind of a thing and man is that kind of a thing. So God might treat somebody like a son and call him a son and do all the things fathers do for sons, but it doesn't mean anything. We're not made of any of the same kind of thing. We're not like God. We can't act like a son of God. We don't have any divinity in us. So how do some churches solve that problem? No problem. God gives you a little bit of divinity. He makes you just a little bit godly. Gives you just a little bit of godness or divineness or divinity or something. And that's the foolishness of it, as the Quran points out to us in many ways. That you could give somebody a lot of things, but there's one thing you can't give. You can't cut it up in pieces and give away helpings of it. You can't give divinity to somebody because of what divinity is. One of the things it means when you say this person has divinity, one of the things you mean is he's always had it. Divinity is not a thing you didn't used to have, but now you have it. Divinity is not a thing you earn or achieve or you reach for and you take it, you get it, or somebody gives it. Divinity has to do with priority. Who is divine has always been divine. You can't start being divine any more than you can stop being divine because of what you mean when you say divine. This is what the Quran is talking about. Says God might adopt somebody, but it'd be an ungodly thing. Can't be done. He wouldn't be acting like God if he did it. Trying to make somebody something that you can't make somebody. Is that our time limit? Am I taking too long with these? About 1,000 years ago, India, yes. So why have they failed to introduce their faith there? Well, of course, there's lots of historians who tell you all sorts of reasons, I suppose, so you have to start to... I can only give you a few indications. Part of the... If you talk about Spain, for an example, the Muslims in Spain were threatened by people who would push them out. And why didn't the rest of the Muslim world come to help their brothers in Spain? They were busy doing something else at that time. You know what they were doing at that time? The Muslims in those years, instead of going to help the Muslims in Spain, they were arguing about, when you make salah, do you raise one finger or do you leave it down when you say tashahhud? They were busy arguing about that, too busy to go and help out in Spain. So that's part of the reason. As to did they plant their faith there, but they did. You see, this is a surprising thing that has come out in recent years. In recent years, things have loosened up in Spain, and there's a lot of Spanish people who have been Muslims all this time. A lot of them were killed for it and so on, but for 500 years, they've managed. Now that they're not afraid, they've come out. A friend of mine who lives in the Emirates has visited there, he's met them, tell you, my family were Muslim all this time back, and we've carried it down. Or you have the situation, he met one man who said he was a Spanish man who had accepted Islam. But he told my friend, come with me, I want to show you something. He took him to his house. He says, my family has owned this house for about 800 years. Took him inside and he showed him the carving and all the woodwork and everything is La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah, and so on. So he says, if I accepted Islam, it really just means I've gone back to what my ancestors had. There's a lot of Spanish Muslims now, and a lot of them had been there all along. When they left, the funny thing is that the Jews went with them, because the Jews knew they'd do better with the Muslims than to stay behind with the people who were trying to throw them out. So if this question is related to the kind of thing about do Muslims try to force things on people, it doesn't really sound likely. The Jews thought they'd do better with the Muslims than anybody else. So I hope that covers that. But it's a thing that a historian could tell you better. There's some fine information that's available in a book a brother just showed me the other day, which is probably easily enough available. It's written by a non-Muslim. It's about the spread of Islam. And he documents all these kinds of things of what happened in each place, country by country. Very interesting. I think that's the last question. What is the Islamic viewpoint on the origin of man and the Darwinian theory of evolution? Well, for one thing, there's all kinds of theories of evolution. The Darwinian theory, there's a neo-Darwinian, and there's all sorts of theories of evolution. The Muslims are in a very embarrassing position in that case, as I think I mentioned the other night. The Quran tells you a little bit about what man is made of and where did he come from, and most of the verses that talk about it are incorrectly translated into English. You know, the verse that says he comes from a fluid between the backbone and the rib and all of that, it doesn't say that in the Arabic. Something else. It tells you about where he came from. And it tells you in that place and other places, whenever it tells you a little bit about the origin of man, it tells you, the reader, that you ought to find out more about it. It says, research it. You look into it. He came from here. He's made of that. You ought to find out about it. And what happens? The Muslims haven't researched that, so that they're in a problem like with this question. They say, well, what happened? Did man evolve? Or did God roll up his big sleeves and he made him one day? What happened? Because he doesn't have any other alternatives. He just has the choices that other people have made, that they fight about in some countries where they say, look, two choices. Either man is a joke, he just happened, doesn't mean anything, or man has only been here for 6,000 years because one afternoon, or no, they'll say it was a Saturday morning, God made him. Some of you think it was October the 4th. And then they say to the Muslim, which one do you believe? You see? You're in a position of saying, well, neither one sounds very good, so you ought to look into it, like the Quran says, find out what is the origin of man. There is a book by that title, just printed last year, by Maurice Boucaille. It's called What is the Origin of Man? And he tries to point out to the Muslims that there's a whole lot of other choices, and maybe some we haven't thought of yet, that explain about where did man come to be, that don't have anything to do with what everybody else is saying.